So what I'm going to do now is try to go through some, in a little more detail, features of Cartesian Kantian skepticism. And what I want to do is give us something such that we can then look at the authors we read for the course. There'll be some authors we look at briefly, some we'll look at in more detail. And we can actually just ask ourselves, does this have a Cartesian shape or a Kantian shape? It's useful to have a way of trying to address that quickly. As we look more closely at some of these authors, the answers will be more complicated. I'm not trying to simplify the issue, but at least have some way of getting an initial take on an author. I want to do this by giving you a set of features for each. It also, I think, avoids having, once you have a whole set of features that are conceptually interrelated, then I think you get a much better lock on what the problematic is. If you just try to do it with a word, does the word possibility occur? Well, doubting the possibility of something versus doubting the reality of something is a pretty good way of putting the difference between Cartesian and Kantian skepticism. But if you make it about the word possibility, that's not going to work. I mean, Cartesians will say, it's always possible that you might be wrong. You say, oh, there's the word possibility. And the Cartesians say, so it's not Cartesian, it's Kantian. If you just try to make it about a piece of terminology, it's not going to work. It's got to be something that has a philosophical shape. And so, to make sure you have a philosophical shape, I think you need a bunch of features that interlock a certain way. The worry about possibility has to lead a certain place, has to have a certain bearing on issues about particularity and generality and reality. So that's part of the point of the features, is to make sure we're really mapping a shape of a problem and not going on, you know, the occurrence of a word that can be put to a very different kind of use. And indeed, one of the things I'm going to want to claim, and I'll even give you an example of this next class, is that there's a lot of very basic philosophical vocabulary. In the case of, say, epistemology or perception, there are words like object, consciousness, phenomenon, epistemic, the given. Let's just take those. I can make this a very long list. But there's something one might call philosophical terminology. These are words you encounter when you read H.H. Price, or Husserl, or Heidegger, or McDowell. Very different philosophers. You'll find words like this, say when they're talking about perception, and a whole bunch of others. We can make this list longer. We will. And I'm going to claim that this whole vocabulary functions a different way depending upon whether we're in a Cartesian or a Kantian register. So you can have philosophers that are literally uttering the same sentences with the same words in it, but their philosophical problem is different. And so it makes it very easy for philosophers to misunderstand each other, talk by each other, think they're disagreeing with each other, we're not talking about the same thing, think they're agreeing when they don't. We'll have examples of both those things. I'll give you concrete examples of those things later. But so this is a further reason why we don't want to make this about terminology. On the contrary, we want to get a certain feeling for what the dialectical structure of philosophical issue is, such that that itself determines what the terminology is doing. So when we go through these features, what's at issue here is how the features are interrelated. It's not an issue of, here's a bunch of words, go look for words. Nine Cartesian features. Cartesian skepticism, if it's Cartesian, the problematic is always going to start with something like a best case, or an ideal case. And so here's a very simple fact about Cartesian philosophy, which already distinguishes it from Kantian philosophy. It's very interesting examples. It's full of examples. You know, if you read Descartes, it starts with these examples. If you read the Critique of Pure Reason, it's hard to find examples. Hilly Putnam once said, there's one example in the book, drawing a line in thought, but he uses it 300 times to make 300 different points. It's a slight exaggeration, but it's not far from wrong. So those are maybe extreme cases, but there's a point here that generalizes across other philosophers. Cartesian philosophy, I'm not saying this is a criticism of Kantian philosophy. I'm saying it's a point about the shape of the issue. Cartesian philosophy originally depends upon a certain kind of traffic, an example. And the Kantian problematic, if you understand what it's doing, makes examples themselves not able to bear that kind of weight. So, further, not just examples, but the example has to be well chosen. It has to be a best case for the philosophical problematic. Now, what best case means can vary. If we just take the perception case, the epistemology, we can develop this in some detail. So, best case means, first of all, the kind of thing with respect to which there are no experts. If I say, that's a Japanese Beetle or an M16 rifle, and I turn out to be wrong, we're not going to get skepticism. So it's always things like chairs, tomatoes, tables, hands. Have to be the kind of thing that we all can tell one when we see one. That's a feature of it. So that's one aspect of it. So one of the things this means is that, to borrow a phrase from Stanley Cavell, Cavell says, in your Cavell reading, you'll see him saying this, I think it's a helpful point here, what you need the Cartesian worry to be about is what he calls a generic object. But the point here is not, there are two kinds of objects in the world. There are generic objects and there are specific objects. This isn't an ontological distinction. So that we can divide the world. And we got to pick tomatoes rather than M16 rifles. Because a tomato is a generic object, and an M16 rifle is a specific object. A tomato can be a Sonoma, California tomato. A chair can be, you know, an Oliver Alto 1936 chair. Any object can be described such that my knowledge of it is of something that is a specific object. And so construed, you're not going to be able to get Cartesian skepticism out of that kind of claim for knowledge. So what makes it a generic object is going to have something to do with the manner under which it's brought up and the manner under which it's scrutinized. It's not just a question about a kind of a thing, but a kind of a question that's being directed at the thing. It's a stand-in for something I can see. How can I know things are as I see them? And so the object is going to be characterized in extremely generic terms. So that all we want to know is that which all I need my senses for in order to know, that minimal way in which it's clear to me I'm engaged with an object there. How can I know that I am engaged with an object the way I think? So part of what best case here means is there's got to be an example. It's got to be an example. There are no experts with respect to it. But it's also an example of an object which clearly isn't a specific object, but that object has to be taken up in a certain kind of way. So the pressure is on, as it were, the kind of cognitive faculty that's being investigated. Knowledge by testimony, knowledge by the senses, whatever the issue. This also means, of course, there can't be any, part of what best case means here is there can't be any questions about the conditions under which we encounter it. So, you know, the lights have to be fine, the distance has to be fine, and so forth, you know. So there's a kind of way in which the Cartesian epistemologist is a little bit like the magician. He says, please convince yourself this is a perfectly ordinary hack. There's a sense in which it's not clear what the question is. It's like, well, I guess so. if it's clear what the problem might be, you know, because my eyesight might be good, not be good, or it's too far away, we're not going to get a Cartesian problem there. So the example has to be structured in very particular ways. I have more to say about this. And John Austin, in the article Other Minds of the Reading, has a lot to say about how he thinks knowledge claims have to be structured. And there's a funny way in which Austin's article is sort of negatively helpful here. Everything Austin says about how the kinds of claims to knowledge he's interested in, when he's talking about goldfinches and so forth, none of that had better be true. We're not going to get a Cartesian problematic. More about that later. Correspondingly in these other areas of philosophy, you're going to have analogs for all of these features of Cartesian skepticism. So, if we were talking about other minds, we talk about somebody flailing in pain, but they might be pretending. That's how you have to construct the Cartesian problematic. You don't say somebody trying to calculate the square root of 5,184 in their head. And whenever they do that, they pick their nose. That's not going to give you a very good example of skepticism of other minds. Again, it's got to be a kind of state that we don't seem to need to know a lot about the person to be able to tell they're in it. We're not experts with respect to telling people are in pain. You have to be a certain kind of expert to tell people are trying to, smuggle agricultural goods across the U.S. border. You know, there are certain people who are very good at saying, "Would you please open your bag? Apples." You don't need that skill. That's not what's at issue here. It's got to be something like telling someone's in pain, and so forth, for all of the features. They've got to be right up close in good lighting. It's not hearing a noise and going, I think someone on the first floor is being tortured. That's not going to get us Cartesian skepticism out of our minds. So you have to structure it analogously this way. How the structural analogies to best case work as you go across different kinds of Cartesian skepticism can itself be an interesting thing to explore. It's not trivial to see how this works. I think, to take the hardest case where the structural analog involves us really seeing in abstract terms how these features work most clearly, I think would be to think about the aesthetics case. If you want to get aesthetic worries going about whether something is a work of art, you need to choose a very certain kind of case. You don't, and what that case itself is there, and this is why I choose this one, for other minds, the example Mill chose works fine now. The example Descartes chose works fine now. In the case of aesthetics, the example is historically conditioned. You've had people worrying for some time now about whether something's a work of art. But Tolstoy's example, and Roger Fly's example, and Clement Greenberg's example, and Arthur Danto's examples are quite different. It's a kind of object that some people think is art, but other people are scandalized by the idea that that could be art. And that example has historical conditions to it. It's not available the way sitting in front of fireplaces. So how the Cartesian best case for generating the skeptical worry looks, if we take other skeptical cases, can be a little complicated. But there are structural features to what goes into it being a generic object. What's an aesthetically generic object as opposed to what's epistemologically a generic object does bear thinking about. Second step in the Cartesian problematic. We raise a worry about this best case. We direct our attention at the generic object. It looks like an awfully good example of something we ought to be able to know through the senses, or know in terms of knowing somebody else's mind, or whatever the area of philosophy we're in. Know in terms of knowing the meaning. Trondheim, that way. Then we raise a doubt about it. And as we've seen, this doubt has to have a very particular structure for it to be Cartesian skepticism. The doubt always involves something that has the structure of an argument from illusion. You build up a case that is, with respect to the inside position, the near side of the gap position, indistinguishable from the case we have now. So if it's philosophy of perception, it's sensuously indistinguishable. If it's other mind skepticism, his bodily state is bodily indistinguishable. His behavioral manifestations are behaviorally indistinguishable from his actually being in pain. And then you say about that, How do you know in this case? But the very construction of that kind of doubt, using an argument from illusion, involves further structure. It involves it always involves an implicit distinction, not always implicit, but at least implicit distinction, between that which is dubitable and that which is invulnerable to doubt. So, when you're generating skepticism in other minds, that I can see how he's outwardly behaving, that it's pain behavior, that's not in question. The question is, how do I know behind the pain behavior there's really pain? That this seems to me a case of being in front of a classroom, being in front of a fireplace, that's not in question. But how do I know it's really a classroom? So there's always a distinction between that which is vulnerable and that which is invulnerable to doubt. And we need a general word for this that covers very different kinds of philosophical cases. And I don't think there is a good word for this. Because people don't tend to try to give this general story about Cartesian philosophy in my sense of Cartesian. But let me introduce a word, which some people have used. Bertrand Russell used this word in a very broad way. I'm taking Russell to be a kind of Cartesian. I think it's a helpful word. So part of Cartesian doubt is something that always involves, in a sense, a paradigm of what knowledge is. A paradigm so it's invulnerable to doubt. There are things that we are acquainted with. And then the structure of the doubt is always one in which one says, the field of acquaintance could be exactly as it is now. But the world beyond what we are immediately acquainted with could be different. So, what's being placed within the purview of acquaintance in the case of philosophy of perception is how things seem to me. Dreaming, seeing, those are different kinds of cases of acquaintance. But then, am I really in the classroom? That goes beyond acquaintance. And then the doubt is about that which goes beyond acquaintance. In the case of other minds, what I'm allowed to be acquainted with is his behavior. How things are with him, that goes beyond the realm of acquaintance. Similarly with testimony, similarly with the past, if you construct a Cartesian view about that, then you're structuring the field of acquaintance as one in which you're saying, well, what is going on now I'm acquainted with? The past goes beyond, and then you've generated the problem by structuring the gap at that point. Where, so there's always a field of acquaintance that is underlying the structure of the doubt. The side which is invulnerable to doubt. And so it's a certain kind of construction of that which is beyond acquaintance, that which you can be acquainted with. Things could be just as they are now with respect to what you're acquainted with, but you don't know. And then you have to respond. There's a lot I could say about that, but I think I won't now. We want to get our different examples. Next point. Once you have such a doubt, if you don't answer it, if you can't, get it to work out that God is not a deceiver, so things must be as they seem to you in acquaintance, or you don't have some strategy for stopping things at this point. Even though you've started with a particular example of a best case, and generated this doubt directed at it, based on the fact that the claim to knowledge goes beyond the field of acquaintance, then it is going to generalize. That's this is a way of, as it were, testing whether you've picked the right kind of example. If the doubt goes through about this example, then the conclusion isn't, I guess Professor Conant doesn't know anything about rifles. But you're not going to be able to conclude, I guess Professor Conant doesn't know anything about when he's in a classroom. Then you conclude, oh my God, he doesn't know that. If you want to say, that is, the I here is now representative of any inquiring person. If you can perform it yourself, if he can't know that, then we can't know things based on our senses. And this is why these features, as I said, are systematically related. These are all aspects of the same philosophical problematic. If you pick this kind of example, and you've directed the right kind of doubt at it, and the doubt can't be withstood, then it will generalize. This particular case turns out to be representative of a whole class of epistemic cases, a class of things you can know by the senses, things you can know by interpreting them, things you can know in virtue of people telling it to you, whatever the category of knowledge we're investigating. So, to put it a little more precisely, I put it more precisely so the contrast with Kantian skepticism can be clear in a moment. We start with a conclusion about a particular candidate item of knowledge. But at this point in the recital, in this third step, the doubt goes through. We move to a conclusion, a general conclusion about all such items. So we start with an investigation of the particular, but we have a conclusion of generality suddenly at this point. Investigation starts apparently with a certain kind of particularity, with the example, with the doubt. But at this point, suddenly, we have the generality of, you know, a form of philosophical skepticism. Once you have that, you also have, you know, a genuinely philosophical puzzlement. You have the sense at this point that you've made a philosophical discovery. You know, if you find out, you know, you can't trust Professor Conant about rifles, or even you can't trust President Bush about weapons of mass destruction, that might be sort of disturbing. But life can go on. You know, in the case of President Bush, it might be hard for Americans, but it goes on. You can still talk about a lot of things. But if this philosophical generalization goes through, it's not quite the same. It looks like you've made a fundamental discovery. There's different ways to put the discovery. But it looks like something we always thought to be true, pre-reflectively, pre-philosophically, something that it sort of looks like has to be true. Namely, that I can know things about the world, or that I can know how people are feeling, or that I can know something about the past. Or take any of these cases, a kind of knowledge that looks like you sort of would have thought we have to have, and certainly Grandma always thought you had it. It suddenly looks like you no longer have an intellectually respectable basis for claiming you have. I want to make it clear. It's not that we now know there is no past, or that we now know there is no external world. That's not the structure of Cartesian skepticism. The structure of Cartesian skepticism is that we're not in a position to know any specific candidate item about the external world. It's a challenge to our knowledge. That is, it suspends our claim to knowledge. It doesn't offer a competing claim to know that there can't be such things. That would be, if you will, an alternative form of dogmatism. It's claiming to be skepticism. So we have this discovery. And the discovery has a kind of character of seeing through our ordinary practices. And many responses, it's worth pointing out here, that many responses to Cartesian skepticism keep, you know, they try to respond, they're so impressed by, as it were, the first three steps of the Cartesian recital, that they often try to respond at this point. That is, they try to keep the discovery, or some sense of discovery that the Cartesians got, saying, yeah, you've discovered something, but it's not that we don't know anything. That's very often the character, especially to what we might call anti-realist responses to Cartesian skepticism. So Berkeley says, it's not true that we don't know the tables and chairs, but it is true that there are no outer objects. Now Berkeley, you know, will actually claim, but this is a hard line, that's what the common sense person claims. So he'll claim this isn't a sort of scene, you know, it's just an analysis of what the common sense person thinks. But so very often, you know, contemporary philosophy people say, it's not that we don't have any knowledge by testimony. We can't have knowledge by testimony. But what it actually is perceptual basis plus inferential basis conjoined a special way. So the idea that this was a distinctive kind of knowledge actually does go down the drain. A certain discovery the Cartesian skeptic thought he made here is being allowed. Or another kind of, you know, answer to the skeptic about the past is say, well, we have knowledge of the past, but what knowledge of the past is are beliefs that are highly probable. And you say, well, that I was in this classroom 3 seconds ago? Well, that's very, very, very probable. You know, that's 99.99% probable. But, you know, well, at this point, the skeptic about memories, since that he made a discovery, hasn't completely been overturned. You might have thought, we just know some things about the past. No, we don't. That's being conceded. So often, responses to Cartesian skeptics start by trying to ward off his conclusion while seeding his sense of discovery. So, you know, an issue in looking at response to Cartesian skepticism is this sense of a fundamental discovery that something we pre-philosophically thought was possible. Does it go through? Something's been overturned, but we withhold the skeptical conclusion? Or are we trying to resist at a point that keeps that discovery from going through? I think it's a fundamental distinction between how people respond to Cartesian skepticism. A further feature of Cartesian skepticism, this is a rather vague feature. I have it for the different kinds of skepticism. We're only going to talk about two for the moment. I distinguish, but I think it's sort of helpful. It doesn't work very well by itself. It's worth thinking about sort of what the mood of the skepticism. Once you've got someone who's really worried about the skeptical problematic, what is the flavor of it? If you compare ancient skeptics to Cartesian skeptics, to people that are really worried about a Kantian skeptical problematic, like Kruppenstein, they actually do have quite a strikingly different mood. Ancient skeptics can be quite happy about their position. You know? It's going to give them tranquility. It's not what later skeptics think. So, Cartesian skepticism in particular, I think, tends to be characterized by a mood of disappointment. There's something we thought we could have, truth, knowledge. Looks kind of basic. And if we let the skeptic win, some people think we should, some people think we shouldn't, but if we let the skeptic win, it turns out we can't have that. I think Richard Rorty is an interesting case here. This is, you know, one of the ways in which I think one can see that Rorty is a kind of Cartesian skeptic, whatever he says, is that his mood is that of disappointment. We once thought there was a God, but it turns out there's no God. We used to think there's truth. It turns out truth is just a compliment we pay our best beliefs. It turns out, well, some people who read Rorty sometimes read it in a sort of very Promethean vein. We're nothing but interpretation all the way down. But if you ever heard Rorty lecture, you'll realize that actually the tonality of it is, we're nothing but interpretation all the way down. Any questions? And the reason you have a mood of disappointment is you have a particular structure in Cartesian skepticism. That is, there's something you can want, and it's part of the structure of Cartesian skepticism that we can form a clear conception of what it is that we want. The idea in Cartesian skepticism is we know what knowledge of the external world would be. But it turns out, if we think carefully about our position with respect to external things, we can't have it. So there's a conception. So the issue is always one of, as I put it before, reality or actuality. That there could be outer things. That's not the issue. The question is, how do I know I'm in bed rather than in front of the classroom? How can I know that? In Descartes, this is very vivid. I mean, Descartes has an idea of something like God's position. From God's position, we can see whether our inner experiences match how things are. The problem is, we don't have that position. So as we think clearly about our epistemic position, we realize it falls short of what we need in order to tell whether the actual case comports with the case we're in. So the word, with the idea of actuality, and the doubt being directed at whether the actual, the real case is of the sort we want, goes the idea that we can frame a conception of what it would be for things to be actually that way. What we can't do is adjudicate whether our position is one that matches our conception of what we would like things to be. So there isn't any probability problem about the intelligibility of knowledge of the external. It's taken to be a coherent idea. The problem is whether we have it. Whether our experiences are veridical. That's why there's going to be a mood of disappointment. Because it looks like there's something we want, which we thought we had, which we can't have. There's a gap, and there's another side to the gap, and we can't get there. That generates, you know, classically, even with little children, a structure of frustration and disappointment. It's right there, you know what it is, you can see you want it, but you can't have it. You can't see that you can have it. Michael?
Yeah, just one answer to I think you're right, absolutely right. But this gap is also kind of creating, let's say, tensions. It's creating interest, you know. If a small child, for example, can something have, it gets interesting. And everything you can have easily is very very uninteresting after a short time. So the gap also has its good senses.
But Descartes' very clear. I mean, this is a very basic. I mean, the disappointment is coming, kicking in a very clear early place here. I mean, Descartes' very clear. Well, I'll tell you what. Let's come to my last feature, and I'll say something about that, okay? Let's do it. But I think when we come to the ninth feature, we'll see something about that. The peculiarity of this case, which makes my analogy with a small child a little problematic. So I was already starting to explicate the sixth feature and spelling out why the fifth feature is what it is, the mood of disappointment, which is that the kind of knowledge, the kind of achievement that the skeptic is directing his doubt at, there's no doubt about the cogency of its possibility. That is always assumed. And this is a huge difference from Kantian skepticism. You might say that's the point where the Kantian skeptical doubt starts. But the question is, are things actually as they might possibly be? Come back to that in a moment, too. I can't believe what time it is. Okay, I'm going to go fast. So, there's a further feature of Cartesian skepticism is that it always has the form of an apparent impotence or inability. It always looks like a limitation of cognitive power. And again, many people, I think, nowadays take this to be constitutive of skepticism. But I think it's really only constitutive of Cartesian skepticism. Cartesian skepticism always looks like our cognitive powers don't reach far enough. We can only be acquainted with this much, and there's something we cannot do. We cannot know that. And so there's always, in a sense, the imposition of a limit. We run up against a limit. And then it turns out that limit kicks in an earlier place than we thought. We thought, you know, pre-reflectively something like, we can know or be acquainted with other people are feeling. And then we think carefully and we go, no, we can see what they're behaving. We can draw inferences on this. But all we ever know is less than what they're feeling. And then it looks like there's no way to actually transverse that limit. So there's always a sense of something you cannot do, an impotence. And with that, you can see how each of these features is really only statable by already presupposing the next one. Goes the idea of two sides to the limit. There's a near side and a far side. And that, you know, as it were, limit then the space between, I've sort of pictorialized with this image of the gap that has to be traversed. It looks like there's this space in between which we can't get across. And then as I pointed out, when we're talking about Cartesian skepticism, what the near side and the far side of the gap is can flip around depending on which kind of Cartesian skepticism it is, but it will always have that structure. Finally, and this is now connects with Mihail's last question, part of what makes the forms, this is one of the things this list of features is meant to do, is distinguish Cartesian skepticism from other forms of skepticism. But another thing it's meant to do is make sure you've got a form of philosophical skepticism, and not just some fundamental non-philosophical doubt, like, can you trust the American government? Which I take is not a form of skepticism. It's a damn good question. So one of the things that Descartes points out about skepticism about perception, but I take it has much further breadth, is that there's kind of practical instability. Descartes just wants to be clear. This is a heuristic doubt. You know, when you leave the study, don't start doubting your senses as you walk down the stairs, and definitely not by the time you get on your bicycle, let alone, you know, start up your car. You know, this is not, you know, a prescription, you know, for a cognitive attitude to take towards the world. And there's even some suggestion, other skeptics, famously Hume, that there isn't anything which would actually be translating the skeptical attitude into a practical attitude. So there's, that's putting it very strongly, but I think putting it slightly less strongly, there's at least a practical instability to the Cartesian problematic always. It's at least always unclear what it would be to affirm the skeptical conclusion and then to try to, as it were, actually practically organize one's practical commitments in the light of acquiescing to it. That's at least always unclear. I want to put it that way because in certain areas of Cartesian skepticism, like testimony, one case, and I think even clearer case is aesthetics, like art. I think, you know, it's not as obvious that you can't actually take up a skeptical attitude and say, you know, no, the skeptic is right. But it's still, if you actually thought about what it would be like to have your practical attitudes all organized by that commitment, usually those sorts of skeptics will still say, well, for practical purposes, of course, we always say blah, blah, blah. But what we're speaking with the vulgar, and what we really mean is, it's very hard to see what it would be to actually have one's practical commitments change. Now, quickly, Kantian skepticism. What happens here with these features is that none of them are the same. But I think you'll also notice that none of them are completely unrelated to the previous ones. That is, there's a kind of displacement of the Cartesian feature, a kind of transformation of it as the problematic takes on this shape. And I think actually if we looked at the transition from ancient skepticism to Cartesian skepticism, if we looked at certain other intermediate cases of two forms of skepticism, we'd find the same thing. As we try to lay out the features, there are there's a structural homology, which isn't the same thing as there being an identity. So in the first instance, one important feature about Kantian skepticism is once you've gotten through to a Kantian level, this is kind of a negative feature, but it's worth making explicit in contrast to the Cartesian one. It doesn't matter what your example is. And that's a remarkable feature of a kind of inquiry. That is, as I put it here, there's a peculiar sort of indifference to the character of the object. If I'm worried about Kantian skepticism about perception, it doesn't matter. If I'm worried about how can a perceptual field so much as present me with an appearance that purports to be thus and so, then that's a skeptical problem that touches my being in front of the classroom or my dreaming I'm in front of the classroom. That's equally problematic, the true and the false. The epistemically ideal, am I standing here right now? Or how I could think I saw a bird at 30 feet, the epistemically non-ideal. All of the distinctions that matter, that we saw, had to be carefully tailored to construct the generic object versus around conditions of expertise and non-expertise, the first person being able to stand in and being representative, along ideality and non-ideality, optimality and non-optimality of conditions, specificity versus generic character of the object, it's being a belief that's a candidate for truth as opposed to something I believe is false. None of that matters. Once you break through to a Kantian skeptical problematic, all of
the dimensions along which you have to distinguish, and there's a whole bunch of dimensions I've just mentioned, to hone your Cartesian example so it generates Cartesian skepticism. On either side of each of those dimensions, pick one, generic versus specific, optimal versus non-optimal, true versus false. You lose both sides if the Cartesian skepticism,
the Kantian skeptical problematic goes through. So what this means is the point I made earlier today when I was saying why you might not think this is a kind of skepticism. What you have, if you're clear about your Kantian skepticism, I think people often aren't. This will come up when we look at Kripke again. Kripke, people think Kripke's a meaning skeptic, or Kripkenstein's a meaning skeptic. They think skepticism is supposed to be a doubt. So they try to formulate the issue there in terms of a doubt about something. That only misses what the real problem is. It starts turning it back into a Cartesian problem. How do I know if he's adding or quadding? Well, there is a philosophical problem you can structure that. So that's a Cartesian problem. That's not Kripke's problem. We're clear about it. I don't think Kripke's completely clear about it. We could say this, it's not Wittgenstein at that point in the investigations. If you're clear about what your Kantian problematic is, you're not possessed by a doubt anymore. An English word which I've discovered by having my work on this translated to other languages, is very hard to translate in other languages, including French and German. And if you're interested, Icelandic, is the word boggle. The Kantian skeptic with respect to his target problematic is not in a relation of doubt. He's in a relation of boggling. How is it so much as possible that
wondering?
Wondering is it's a very specific kind of wondering. I can wonder about something without being in any doubt that the question has an answer. But here, the boggle tends to swallow the very capacity to engage in this sort of wonder. I am right now having an experience of being in a classroom. But how is that so much as possible? But it's very hard for me to take the attitude of, maybe I can't have such experiences. I wonder if I can have them. That's not a real option. You can't sort of suspend, commitment to the idea that we have determinate contents. And one sees this most clearly, as I was saying last time, if you take the language case. The very formulation of the boggle commits you to the idea that the question you're asking, the wonder you're formulating, at least that has a determinate content. So boggle is meant, I think a helpful Kantian word, as I was suggesting last time here, is schematization. It has the form of a sense of wonder that one can so much as schematize the phenomenon in question. And the act of formulating that attitude of boggling itself involves schematization. When we're worrying about the schematism in Kant, we are schematizing while we do it. There isn't anything which is stepping back. This is why it's not like the Cartesian problematic, which always divides to an area of invulnerability on this side of what we're acquainted with. There we feel safe. Cartesian skepticism always has this feeling. But once we go beyond that, we're venturing into the realm of the epistemically risky. What his body's like, that's safe. What's going on inside, that's a risky claim. How things seem to me, that's safe. How things are in the world, that looks risky. There's no ground of safety once you've got the Kantian problem. There's no place to retreat to. The place you're trying to prosecute the inquiry from is itself starting to collapse under your feet as you're doing it. Hence, I say boggle. I'm going to not take your question because I'm already late. I'm going to just go through this real fast. So I'm just going to just say these so you have a sense of how they contrast with the Cartesian ones. Third feature, we don't start from a particular case and then thinking it through have the bottom drop out, so we have a general conclusion. In Kantian skepticism, say it's philosophy of perception, the worry is, how can you so much as have an experience of a particular? Hume says we have impressions of this, we have impressions of that, but how can we know blah, blah, blah? The Kantian problem becomes, how can you so much as have a Vorstellung of something? So the particulars from which we start themselves are impugned. Fourth feature, that means you don't have a sense of a discovery. The discovery presupposes the next feature of there being something intelligible. It's being doubted. You have a sense of mystery, that a certain kind of phenomenon doesn't now seem to be possible. And so this is why Kantian answers always have the form of, how can we give a description of the world in which these sorts of things, meanings, experiences of the world or whatever, no longer seem mysterious? I think this is part of the reason naturalism is increasingly the dominant form of philosophical explanation, because the questions are dominantly Kantian. And naturalism holds out at least the appearance of giving an answer in which no mysterious entities are postulated. Because what we're trying to do is make a phenomenon seem unmysterious. The mood isn't one of disappointment. You can only be disappointed if you know what you want but you can't have it. The mood, Kant says already in the Prolegomena of skepticism, when he's talking about his kind of skepticism, is despair. Because the very kind of capacities we're drawing on in asking our question draw the possibility of being able to do that itself into question. So our mood is one of despair, I say. I think we better stop. I haven't gone through the GIF, the list, but if you go, I think you should be able to just be able to keep going, using the list itself, using the Cartesian features, seeing how they displace. Okay, so what we're going to do next time, I'm sorry I'm falling behind, is we're going to look at a passage from H.H. Price and C.I. Lewis. I quote the two passages in my article. You might just read those two quotations. We'll start with them. My claim is they have a lot of words in common. They're both on a books on perception, on chapters on perception. They're both in chapters called The Given, which are at the beginning of such books. Reading them quickly, you might say they're about the same thing. My claim is that Price has a Cartesian problematic. Lewis has a Kantian problematic. And then what we're mostly going to do next time is try to get clear what Lewis's problematic is. What is it really to be a Kantian about perception? How does that change the problem from the Cartesian problem? Because I think Lewis's agenda in philosophy of perception is really the one that we have now. Lewis is one of the people who made that urge. It doesn't mean he's now famous, but that's part of when the change really started to happen, thinking about perception. So that's what we're going to do next time. So please read especially chapter 2 of the Lewis carefully.